And tonight's speaker comes to us from the Fifth Tradition Group. I hear she is very involved, and I know I'm almost excited as Tim to hear your story. So with that, we have Erica.
Hi, everybody. My name is Erica, and I am an alcoholic. Really happy to be here. My sobriety date is November the 23rd of 2022. And like what was just said, my home group is the Fifth Tradition Group. I also attend meetings here at NABA at 7:30 in the morning sometimes, and Big Book Studies. There's just so many good meetings around Atlanta that I like to attend. And I am grateful to Tim for asking me to come and speak tonight. So, like you just heard, tonight I'm going to talk about what I was like, what happened to me, and what I am like now. So, I'm going to take it back to my childhood, and I'm going to try to go in order of the steps so that those of you who aren't familiar with the 12 steps can kind of see how the steps have played out in my life before and after sobriety. Step one talks about powerlessness and unmanageability. So you're probably looking at me like, oh, she looks like she has it relatively together. What the heck is she doing up there? Well, I'll be the first one to tell you that even from the time that I was very young, I had this, the Big Book calls it like restless, irritable discontent. I had this feeling like I wasn't a normal kid. I grew up in a normal household, didn't have any major traumas or issues. My parents divorced at 14, but other than that, we were kind of living kind of a good life. But I never felt good in my skin. I never felt like I belonged with other girls at school. I never thought I was good enough or smart enough. And we grew up in church, and we grew up in a very strict religious environment where there were a lot of rules. And so me trying to be the good girl that I was always trying to follow the rules. And every time I would make a mistake or fall short, make a B instead of an A in school, I would kind of beat myself up. And this was under the age of 10. Also in church, I learned about heaven and hell. And I was introduced at a very early age to an idea of God that was punitive, judgmental, angry, this guy in the sky with a white beard that was just waiting for me to mess up so he could throw lightning bolts at me. So that was my conception of God in the church I grew up in, and that really was my conception of God leading up into coming into this program. So as I got older, powerlessness and unmanageability looked like overachievement. After time, I was able to make the straight A's. I was able to achieve things. I went on mission trips with my church. I was the good Christian girl. I was doing Bible studies. I was leading worship. I was kind of looked at as this mentor. I got a doctorate degree. I started teaching as a professor at Duke University in their School of Nursing. Over time, I began to find that no matter how much I achieved, it wasn't quieting down this restless, irritable discontent, this feeling of I just don't fit in my own skin and I don't belong. I had my first drink at age 17. Prior to that, I really didn't have access to alcohol. However, the first time I drank, which was at our graduation party senior year in high school, I got very, very, very drunk and ended up in a situation where this guy was on top of me trying to take my clothes off. I was in a park. It was dark. Police were called. That was my first experience with alcohol. I have to say that was traumatic enough for me to kind of say, I don't think I want to deal with alcohol. And so throughout college, I didn't really drink much, very little socially. My drinking actually started picking up in my adult years. So like I said, I had gotten some good jobs, bought a house, bought a car. I was teaching at Duke University. I'm this like university professor. I've got my own business, and everyone around me thinks that I have it all together. They're like, oh, she's very professional, very well put together. What they didn't know is that inside, that idea of feeling not good enough, feeling like I didn't belong, feeling like if anyone knew who I really was, they wouldn't want me teaching, they wouldn't want me to be their nurse, they wouldn't want me around them if they knew how horrible of a person I was. And the reason why I felt so horrible was because old idea that I had of God, thinking that, you know, I've got to be perfect to get into heaven, and if I'm not perfect, then I have to overcompensate. And then it got to the point to where the overcompensating wasn't enough, and I started drinking. I started drinking more socially. It got to be around COVID. It got to be a little bit more often. I ended up meeting this really great guy at church, and I thought, okay, he's gonna fix me. Like, if I can just check this box off, I'll have the husband, the house, the car, the degree, all the stuff that they tell you to get in the American dream. And it just so happened that this guy broke up with me, and he really didn't give a good reason. He was just like, I'm just not feeling you. Perhaps he picked up on my desperation and my, please like me, please like me, please love me. I'm sure that had something to do with it, but I was devastated. And after that relationship fell apart, my drinking got worse. I also started dealing with outside issues. And then I started trying to play my own doctor. So I would take a little of this over here, so maybe I won't drink as much if I take this, or maybe if I smoke this, then I won't take that. So it was like being a mad chemist trying to do whatever I could to keep up that persona that I did not want to fall apart. And eventually that caught up to me. So shortly after that breakup, I went into a deep depression, and I ended up trying to take my life. I mixed all the substances together, and I lay down on the floor, and I was like, God, if you're up there, will you please just let me into heaven? I failed at life. No one loves me. No one cares. No one wants to be with me. It's a pretty cool, miraculous story, but I ended up waking up at Northside Hospital slightly disappointed because I thought I felt myself drifting up into the heavens, and then I'm slammed back down in the ER, and there's nurses, and there's tubes all in me, and they're like, wake up, wake up, wake up. They had to Narcan me a few times. And so I woke up really startled, and I kind of had this feeling like, God, like, why did you save my life? I told you I didn't want to be here anymore. But miraculously, someone had found me and called 911, and that's how I ended up there. Well, then, of course, I got put on a psych hold, and I went to a psych hospital and was put on a 1013 for a week. So I'm like, great, okay, now I'm the girl who tried to kill herself, and now I'm a mental health patient. Great, my resume is getting better and better. Someone will really love me after this, right? So after getting out of that psych ward, that's when COVID kind of came around. And so I was still working as a nurse, but I was working mostly telehealth. So there were a lot more opportunities to drink, so my drinking escalated. It escalated. We'll get to you after. My drinking escalated to the point to where I was drinking 2 to 3 bottles of wine at night. I had isolated myself. I wasn't hanging out with my friends. I was, you know, the big book talks about, in More About Alcoholism, the things that we do to try to hide our drinking. You know, I said I'd never drink at work, and then I said I'd never drink while I was driving, and that happened. And then I started hiding many bottles of wine at work in my medication fridge. And all the things that I said I wasn't going to do, I ended up doing. And this was not just with drinking, it was just acting out in general. I had several relationships with different men. Some of them were married. That was one of the things that I thought was wrong. You know, adultery is one of the 10 commandments, and you will go to hell if you do that. Well, I didn't care anymore. So the progression of my alcoholism also went along with the progression of my mental health. And there came a time when my mental health began to suffer so much that I actually started having manic episodes, panic attacks. I was not taking my regular antidepressants that I'd been put on at the treatment center, and I started really spiraling. and I kind of just pray to God again, like, if you're up there, I need some kind of help. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I can't let anyone know I'm suffering because so many people have such a high perception of me. I can't show anyone my weakness, especially as a nurse, as a professor. No one wants their nurse to be an alcoholic. No one wants their nurse to be struggling in silence with mental health. Like, who can I tell? It just so happened that I ran into a friend of mine who went to my church, and we just kind of got talking, and I had known her enough to trust her with that I was struggling, and she told me that she also was an alcoholic, and she was 5 years sober. And this was someone I knew from my church growing up, had no idea that she had been an alcoholic and gotten sober. So she ended up referring me to an alcohol meeting. I also found out she works in the treatment industry. She actually worked for a treatment center. She'd completely changed her career, and she helped me get into a treatment center. So I finally signed up for the treatment center. She recommended me to a women's AA meeting in Vining, so I went there just to kind of try to keep myself busy during those last days before treatment, and suddenly my cat got sick, and her paw got really swollen, and the skin just started, like, falling off of her paw out of nowhere. Like, this literally happened overnight, and I had a plane ticket to go to treatment that next Monday. So I went to this AA meeting, and I had shared with my friend about what happened with my cat, and I'm like, well, I'm single. Like, no one's going to want to take care of a cat, especially a cat that's going to need boarding and wound care, multiple dressing changes, and I was just like, I'm not going to go. And it so happened in that meeting that when I shared that with my friend in the program, she told one woman who told another woman, and soon after that meeting, I got a call from one of the women in that meeting with 25 years of sobriety, and she said, I heard you're having an issue with your cat, and I heard that you're trying to go to treatment. She said, well, I'm a veterinarian. I only work with cats. She has a veterinary practice where she only sees cats. And she said, bring your cat to me. I will watch her like she's my own. I'll do all the care, all the boarding. I want you to get on that plane and go to treatment. So I'm saying that to kind of set in motion here that God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. Before I came into the rooms, before I had a spiritual experience, the God of my understanding, not my misunderstanding, not the childhood God, but the God that I came to know as the God of my understanding in AA, was already working on my behalf. I went to treatment, had a lot of mental health issues, trauma to deal with. I took advantage of everything that was offered to me in treatment as far as counseling, therapy, all of it. I'm like, just sign me up for all of it because this is the worst I've ever felt in my life, and I don't ever want to go through this again. I had actually become suicidal during my first few weeks of treatment because I could not imagine a life without alcohol. There was just a complete blank there. If I don't have my crutch, if I don't have my friend that keeps me company every night and helps me make it through the day, I don't see a way to live anymore. So I was back at that place. And in A Vision for You, it gives a really good description of what that bottom was like for me. It says there was a chilling, dark vapor that had kind of set on me. And I could not imagine a life without alcohol. And so in AA, I was taught that when I come in here, I have a choice. I can either go on, keep drinking, die a horrible alcoholic death, end up jails, institutions, dead, or I can choose a spiritual way of life. So at the time, both of those seemed not great options to me. Of course, I didn't like being suicidal, but I'm like, okay, well, God saved my life, so I don't think I'm going to get away with that one again. And then it's living a spiritual way of life. And I'm just like, there is no way that the God that I grew up with can be the God that helps me to get sober in AA. So when I came in, I was I was a little antagonistic towards the God thing just because of my old experiences and just because of that picture of God as this punishing being that I had growing up. One of the first things that I learned when going through the steps is that when I came in here, I could have my own understanding of God. And that didn't make any sense to me. I was taught, you believe the God that the pastor tells you is a God in the Bible. You don't get to make up your own God. That's on some other stuff. That's a cult. So I had those types of thoughts to kind of deal with and battle as I came in. And initially what I had to do was I had to let the faith of the people in AA be my higher power. I came into these rooms and I saw people who were smiling. I saw people who seemed to be happy. I also heard people's stories, and I could relate to those feelings of hopelessness. I could relate to the feeling of never felt right in my own skin, never felt good enough, always felt like there was something wrong with me, always feeling like I had to wear a mask. So I came in and I heard y'all tell your stories. And the big book says we're a people that normally would not mix. So I had to learn to look for the similarities. When I came into AA, it was middle-aged white demographic. Didn't see a lot of people who looked like me. And what I had to learn was to begin to see the similarities. So I began to listen with my heart. I began to relate, and I began to connect. And for a time, the faith of other people in AA was able to be the higher power for me until I came to believe myself. I ended up meeting a great sponsor who took me through the book. I had found a really good book study in treatment. They made us go to AA. It was not an option. I am truly grateful to that. I have to say, I'm grateful for treatment centers that at least give people an exposure to AA, because I don't know that I would have stuck with it. I had to get a sponsor. I had to work the steps. And that was just to be able to graduate from the program. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do this thing. I'm going to go for it. Nothing else had worked. And so I found a sponsor in a big book meeting. I went into the meeting, and they were reading line by line out of the big book, the first 164 pages, line by line. So the other issue I had when I first came into treatment was that I was so messed up mentally, like I could not read. Someone had given me a big book, and I took it with me to treatment. I could not sit down and be still long enough to read. And then when I did try to read, there were all these archaic words from the 1930s, and I'm just like, what the hell are they talking about? Like, I can't connect with this. And so when I started going to a big book study where they went line by line and explained, these are what the words mean, here's the history of AA, and kind of brought the story alive for me to where I could see myself on the pages, I really, really began to have an interest in working these steps. And so I asked someone in that group to sponsor me and took me through the steps. And I will tell you that I had a spiritual experience that was nothing like anything I'd ever felt in church. I was challenged when we were reading We Agnostics. There's a word that occurs in there several times, prejudice. And I have thought of prejudice where maybe someone doesn't like a certain race. That was the only way I had heard prejudice described in my life. But I saw it come up several times in We Agnostics. And that sponsor helped me to see that Bill Wilson was saying, prejudice are old thoughts. Old thoughts, old ideas. So Bill Wilson was asking me to set aside prejudice multiple times in We Agnostics. So for me, that meant that my old conception of God, this rigid being, had to be set aside for me to be able to be in AA and have a spiritual experience unlike anything I'd had before. I was afraid because I had never felt God outside of being in a church building. But what I knew was that when I came into AA, even the first time when I was with those women, I felt the presence of something that I can only describe as spirit or God. And it was weird because I'm like, how am I kind of feeling this love of a spirit like in an AA room? That was kind of my first introduction, as well as seeing coincidences happen that were really not coincidences, showing me that there was a bigger being out there that wanted me to be alive, that wanted me to be sober, and wanted me to be in these rooms. Finally, after some time of wrestling, I was able to set aside my old ideas, and I said, okay, I can start with a very simple conception of God, like I just said. Do I believe God wants me to be alive? Yes. My life was saved miraculously when I wanted to end it. Do I believe God wants me sober? Yes, because a stranger went out of her way to watch my cat and nurse her back to health and board her for over 30 days without even knowing who I was, just so that I could go to treatment. And do I believe God loves me? So that one was a little bit of a struggle that I had to work through, because, like I said, those old ideas, the old version of God did not love me. He was never happy. Nothing I did was ever good enough. But I came to realize that a lot of the teachings that I had grown up with also did point to a God of love. There were scriptures that said, for God so loved the whole world, and it's like I had tunnel vision, and I was not looking at those attributes of God, but it was almost like when I came in AA, I got, like, permission. I got permission to experience those attributes of God that were love, that wanted me to be alive, to have a purpose, to help others, and to be sober. And so I definitely feel that doing these first three steps, coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, that was as the result of really having to turn over those old ideas and really having to be open-minded and willing to a God of my understanding. And so what that began to look like was, it's kind of hard to explain. Everyone has a different type of spiritual experience. Mine, it kind of happened in the moment, but it still continues to happen today. Some people describe like a white light experience. Some people have a slower experience that just kind of happens as they go through the steps. So I kind of had both. I had an experience with my sponsor where we were going through We Agnostics, and it was time to say the third step prayer. Am I going to make a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God, as I understand? And that word care really stuck out to me, because when I turn over my life to the care of my higher power, that's different than just saying I'm giving my life over to God. Something about that care word really connected with the love that I've been feeling in the rooms. And that's really what kind of broke down those walls. And like I said, I was not in a church building. I felt the immense power of God's love come over me. And I felt that with me as I continued to go through the steps. Like I said, I got a sponsor. I worked through the steps. I remember getting to steps 4 and 5, having to do an inventory. Everyone had told me that, oh, you're going to relapse. So writing the inventory is hard. No one makes it through the inventory. And I said to myself, nothing else that I've done has worked. And I sure as heck don't want to go back to wanting to die. If these are the clear-cut actions that are laid out in the book for me to do, I'm just going to push through and do it. So through the emotions, through the memories, through mood swings up and down. One day I want to write, the next day I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. I finally got through it, and I was able to bring that full inventory to my sponsor at the time. I just said to God, I want to put every single thing on here that could be blocking me from you. And I went all the way back to resentments from like kindergarten. I probably overdid it. You know, I'm an overachiever. But I went all the way back to every person I'd had a resentment against, every relationship I had been in, and just really took a hard look at those patterns, my character defects. And I sat across from a woman who sat with me for a total of 9 hours. Now, that's not typically how long an inventory is, but I felt like she knew how important it was and how, for me, it was a life or death mission, just like it says it has to be in the book. When I was done with all of that, she looked me in the eyes and said, "I love you, and you never have to do those things again. It's been exposed. You got it out. You never have to do those things again as a sober woman. Because what's happening is that I'm tapping in a power, infinite wisdom, infinite love, a power that can keep me from the first drink." Because really my problem wasn't the drinking. It wasn't 2 to 3 bottles of wine a night. It was lack of power. It was me trying to live in my own strength, living a self-destructive lifestyle, trying to keep all the wheels turning in my own strength and drowning the whole way. So had an amazing fifth step and inventory. Step 6 and 7 is where my sponsor helped me to see character defects. I noticed a lot of patterns, especially in relationships. I was demanding. I was manipulative. I put way more pressure on these guys to be what I wanted them to be, and that's what pushed me away from ever having been able to have a healthy relationship. And even in other relationships, I realized I'd been neglecting my family. I had been completely isolated in my alcoholism. So I was going home every night after work, drinking sometimes on the way home from work, and I was sitting by myself in a dark room in front of a TV, drinking till I passed out every night. And that is what the last year of my drinking looked like. I had pushed my family away. I made excuses. I didn't show up at family events because I was sick. I had a young niece and nephew. They were doing all kinds of sports, gymnastics, and I constantly came up with excuses as to why I couldn't make it. I remember even one Christmas, I left Christmas early and told them I wasn't feeling well because I wanted to just go home and be by myself and drink on Christmas. So in making that amends process, what that looked like for me, I was directed by my sponsor that the amends is not just saying I'm sorry, because a lot of times our loved ones have heard I'm sorry many, many times before and haven't seen a change. So I was told to let my actions speak louder than words. I didn't do all of my amends immediately because I also wanted to be sure that I was going to do this way of life. And it turns out that my family actually started seeing changes in me, in my character. They started seeing that I had a light about me. They started seeing changes in me before I ever made amends. And other people around me in the program were starting to see changes in me. And so at that point when my family started to notice, that's when I shared with them what I'd been doing in AA and made my amends to my family members. I also had to make amends to an old boss at my job for the stuff I was doing at work. That amends process still continues to go on. That's kind of a lifetime process. So steps 10 and 11, so I learned in the Big Book study that kind of look at those as the maintenance steps. It's basically doing all the steps leading up to that, but kind of in a condensed way on a daily basis. That means prayer and meditation. For me, at first, I didn't know how to pray other than the way I was taught to pray in church. So for me, that looked like saying the third step prayer in the mornings. It looked like saying, "God, please keep me sober today." And at night, "Thank you for keeping me sober." It looked like taking time out for gratitude. And over time, as I began to become more and more unblocked from my higher power, I began to let the God of my understanding into all different areas of my life. And so now it's a lot more like a conversation. Step 10 also tells us that we need to continue to admit our mistakes. So making amends promptly when something comes up today. If I do something to someone or I talk to someone in a certain way and it's just not jiving with my spirit, it's like God's like, "No, you need to go make an amends for that immediately." Because for me, to hold on to that for days and days and to keep that festering, that will make me drink again. And like I said, I'm on a life or death mission here. So one of the beautiful things that I got from having had the spiritual experience is a God consciousness, a constant knowing that my higher power is right here within me, that any time, no matter what's going on in life, because life's still life, there's still ups and downs, life has not been a picnic, but I now have tools, and I have a power that I can tap into. The big book tells me that no matter what's going on, if I'm ever disturbed, I can pause and ask for the next right action or direction. And it also says, if I don't know what that is, then the next thing I can do is do something nice for someone else, be of service to someone else, say a kind word to someone else, and the answers will come. Along with helping others, that's one of the most enjoyable parts of my sobriety today. I get to work with other women. I sponsor women. I get to. It's not that I have to. I get to work with other women. I get to tell my story. I get to share the solution that was presented to me in this book, line by line. I get to walk women through line by line, word by word, just like it was done for me. I get to be the witness of a miracle happening right before my eyes. And it's one of the most beautiful parts of my sobriety today. And there have been lots of God stories that have happened even since I got sober. I'll give you one example. So I'm in my third year of sobriety. In about my second year of sobriety or so, I kind of got impatient with God, started trying to take my will back, and I'm like, okay, God, I'm a year sober, year and a half sober, where's my man at? I'm pushing 40, where's he at? I did everything you said to do, I checked the 12 boxes, so, you know, those old ideas started coming back, and I began to get really obsessed with fertility and, you know, going to fertility clinics, getting all the testing done, seeing if I could afford IVF, have a baby on my own. And I got really, really deep into that to the point to where it became an obsession. And it was really beginning to block me from being able to be effective with other women and in the program. And so I finally had to sit down with my sponsor and I did another inventory, believe it or not. You do these steps more than once. They're not just a one and done. So we did a spot check inventory, looked at my fears. What is it that I'm really afraid of? Where am I not trusting God? Where have I gotten back into the driver's seat, just like I was doing when I was still drinking? And I was able to identify those things and then say, okay, God, I'm letting this go. And so a short time after that, a pastor from the church I had grown up in, I went to like a mega church. So a pastor who had heard that I had been to treatment, hadn't talked in years, he reached out to me randomly saying, hey, Erica, I heard you went to treatment. My daughter is struggling. She's going to kill herself with alcohol. She's got a young baby. Her husband is fed up. We've tried talking to her. We've given her every resource available from the church. Is there any way you can just go talk to her? And I said, sure. This was on a Saturday, so I went over to her house. She was in bad shape. She'd been throwing up. Her husband came to the door and was just like, I'm done with her. She's in there. And so what I ended up doing is what I learned in this book. Bill Wilson talks about, well, to reach someone, why don't you tell them how you drank? Why don't you tell them how you felt? So I didn't go in there trying to convince her to go to treatment. I told her my story. And she was able to relate with a lot of my story because we'd grown up in the same church. But I also told her what my solution was. And I also let her know that I had found my solution for me outside of a church building, and that I was doing AA, and that it was working. It was what was keeping me sober. I didn't knock religion in any way, because I know her dad was a pastor, but I said, well, if any of this resonates with you, I'm happy to take you to detox, and we do this thing one day at a time. And so she eventually agreed to go to detox. I took her to detox that day. She stayed in for 30 days. She ended up getting out. A month later, she posted on Facebook that she was pregnant. She was pregnant with a little girl, and that she had continued to stay sober. Well, a week or two ago, she posted on Facebook her 1 year of sobriety, and she put up several pictures of her family, the pastor, his wife, all her extended family members, and she's holding the little girl in her arms, and she put on Facebook, "I'm healing out loud so others don't have to suffer in silence." And for me, if there was no other proof that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be right now, doing exactly what I'm supposed to do, then that was it. This woman had every religious resource available to her, including very loving parents, very religious parents. And they called me because something told them, well, she's been through it, maybe she can reach her. And that's the privilege that I have today as an alcoholic. I can reach people that no one else can. My past, which used to be something that I was ashamed of, has actually become my biggest weapon. It talks in the book, In the Family Afterwards, and it says, when we put our dark past into God's hands, our dark past can actually help save other lives. And that's why today I'm not afraid to tell my story. I've shared my story at work. I still work in the healthcare industry. I'm still a nurse. I actually ended up getting a job at a treatment center. Go figure. Never would have seen that coming. So not only do I get to help others as part of my profession, I still get to pass along this message for fun and for free. And there's no greater than honor than that for me today. So if you're new, I encourage you, even if your treatment center's kind of pushing you to come to these meetings and you're not sure if it's going to work for you, I invite you to give it a try. Willingness, honesty, open-mindedness will open the doors for you. You will be blown away by how your higher power will come in and make a way for you where you thought there's no way you could get or stay sober. Thanks for letting me share.
First I slipped, and then I quit, to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window, for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is, all is. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Look into love's window, for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promise. Thank you. Take me where the promise is.